Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to this reading by Frieda Hughes of her poems and presentation of her paintings. We have to thank Arts Council England for sponsoring the festival. Without their help, we wouldn't be able to do anything. From her childhood, writing and painting have been the driving forces behind Frieda Hughes's life and her commitment to life. She started out as a children's writer, published several children's books before publishing her first poetry collection, Wooraloo, in 1999, which was followed by Stonepicker, Waxworks, and The Book of Mirrors, all published by Blood Axe. In 2002, she got her Nestor Award to work on 45, her portrait of her life in poems and paintings, the poems from which were published in the US in 2006. That was the beginning of a growing collaboration between her poetry and artwork, now further realised in the book she's reading from and talking about today, Alternative Values, which includes her most explicit work relating to the lives and deaths of her parents, Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath. Would you please welcome Frieda Hughes?
Thank you very much, Neil, and welcome all of you. I like the musical accompaniment. I'm going to give you a little bit of a whistle-stop tour of some of the other books before I get on to Alternative Values, just to give you a little bit of a flavour. And if I move the glass closer now, they can worry about whether or not I knock it over the computer. Wooraloo, my first poetry collection, was written while I was still living in Australia, hence the quite bright cover. I painted my covers. I'm not very good at asking for help, but when I was faced with a stack of poems, it was getting bigger and bigger, and it came to the point where I thought, well, I should try and publish something. I asked my father for help. I didn't say, I want you to tell me what I should do. I didn't say, I need to ask you how I should change these. I just said, make three piles. Good, bad, could be better if you worked on them. And he was very good. He did just that. Didn't say a word, just made three piles. And in the good pile was the following poem. When I wrote it with the idea that he was looking after the legacy of my mother's poetry. Birds. The poet, as a penguin, sat in his snow cold, nursing the egg his wife had left him. There it was, born of them both, like it or not, rounded in words and cracking open its shell for a voice. In the blizzard, beaten up from the Arctic flats, were the audience. From the glass extensions of their eyes, they watched the skuas rise on the updraft, every snap of their beaks like the tick of a knitting needle, hitching a stitch in the wait for a rolling head. Because, of course, I'd had this idea that my father, with the legacy of my mother's poems, would get hit by occasional brickbats and criticism. He looked at this poem, and he said, I particularly like this one. It's about you. I'd never thought of that, and I've never been able to get away from that now. And I suspect he was absolutely right. Stonepicker, the collection that followed. The poems, as we go through the poems, they become increasingly personal. But this one's quite personal. When I was a child, a little friend of mine, was given a toy bird, and I discovered for the first time real envy. The birdcage. It is bright and gold, ring-holed at the top for a chain. A little girl is caught in its bars as surely as the toy bird. Each of them perch-bound, one looking out, the other peering in, but trapped by those green and blue feathers and the bead of a dead eye. not given to her, she must watch another child carry the canary to a hot spot on the radiator for its trick. And there it is left in the rising air. The bird shudders as if life has just been forced back through its yellow beak and into its small mechanical breast. Its wings open, its tail spreads, and suddenly it is singing. I should have been yours. I should have been yours. I once did a series of three or four programs for The Last Word. I was on The Last Word, which is on Morfor. This was a while ago. And it was a topical program, and we'd discuss politics, whatever was in the news at the time. And on one of my visits, I walked into the green room, and I was a little surprised to be greeted enthusiastically by a quite nice-looking man who leapt up, shook my hand, and he said, "Hello, I'm the editor of Nuts. I really like your poetry." I couldn't quite work out why the editor of Nuts magazine, being soft porn as it is, actually I don't know how pornographic it is, but I do know it has these in it. Breasts. And this is the one that had caught his eye. Scarred beneath their bags of heavy silicon, they were mountains, shored up and sharpened, a handful of the mine's mud at a time. Those breasts weren't for a limp sweater or a bra size more than two sources. Those breasts had purpose. Men's eyes would unpage magazines for a sight of them. Melissa was no longer required to speak. Her breasts could talk. They had a language, and everyone understood. When at last she made the photo shoot, she gently placed her breasts of shiny plastic flesh upon the table for the cameraman and left. Following on with Waxworks. Waxworks is a collection of poems, sort of based, a lot of them are allegorical, based on characters from our criminal history, from fairy tales, and I was trying to think, there are one or two that wrote their own poems, but quite often there's one, Cinderella, that I wrote, which is a sort of update of Cinderella. But this one in particular, he is himself, and out of all the poems, I felt very much as if he wrote it almost over my shoulder and almost as if I had nothing to do with it. It just came straight out onto the page. Vlad the Impaler. I love to see the little trees, their branches cut, their barbs like sharpened spears, be blunted by adorning heads. Apple-bobbing fleshy balls with eyes a-popping and ears to give a starling purchase where once were twigs. And see my arch of bones, a tangled thing of limbs, as stripped and bare as crows can make, and leading off my avenue of stakes, rise tall above a man, each topped off by a face in which two puddles for a thirsty beak were irises, till thirst was quenched and holes began. And here I roll your children's heads, orifices fit for fingers, jaws wired for silence, and play skittles with their arms and legs. It's a collection of very dodgy people, this book. The one I'm going to read, is the Second Horseman. At the end of the book, there are the four horsemen of the apocalypse from Revelation 6. And what I did was I used going through the Bible, because several of the characters in the book are based on biblical characters, although they're updated to be us, effectively. One review of this book said, oh, this poem's so out of date. And I'm going to let you make your own mind up. Each of these horsemen was given a job using the tools that the Bible gave them. And so the second horseman, it says in Revelations, and there went out another horse that was red, and power was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, and that they should kill one another. And there was given unto him a great sword. The horseman's sword bisects a father's reason from belief. Unfettered by thoughts, his belief aspires to become a reason in itself, and he gives up his boy for it. The boy bomber is strapped into his kill suit. He will go off spectacularly. Inside, all his little sons and daughters huddle their halves in his scrotum. They would have opened like flowers and bloomed in a woman's womb. They would have been the best he did if he did nothing else. His father, having seen his son used as a weapon, is proud, himself now becoming a dead end. Not so out of date, I think. We move on to the Book of Mirrors. As I said, this is a whistle-stop tour of the previous ones. I believe it is pointless to argue with anyone whose ego is attached to the outcome. And so this is a poem about that futility. To the victor, an empty chalice. See their gritted teeth and glassy stare, fixated on whatever it is they want to get hold of, glittering or shining or promising supreme satisfaction. It is going to cost them more in time or effort or money than they will ever win. It could be a man or a woman or their own way or the conclusion of a well-thought-out plan. Their perpetual state is confrontation, their lawyers on speed dial to secure the secrecy of their efforts. The corpse of their smile reflects all the little deaths behind their ocular pebbles that record their success. Whatever it is, hand it over. Look, they want it so badly. Their whole life is the fight it defines them. Without it, they're pointless. Let them win and fall over. Or continue to suffer their malice. Let them have it tonight, just give in, be free from conflict, and allow them the prize. To the victor, an empty chalice. Next time somebody wants to have an argument with you, think about whether or not that might apply. Pheasants. Where I live, there are a great many of them, and a friend of mine is looking after 20,000 at the moment, rearing them for the pheasant season. And after the release of which, my garden will be full, because they know that they're quite safe. So I get a lot of chances to observe pheasants, and there's a little pheasant trilogy in the back of this book. And we're just going to have pheasant running. Startled, his head rockets to the end of his neck. His neck, since it is attached, stretches like a rubber hose. His body, since it is attached, drags behind like a bag of washing in the arms of a short person, gathering momentum, bouncing atop two sticks of an afterthought to suddenly catch up with the head and astonish it by swallowing the intervening length of vertebrae. Now his head is fixed like a doorknob to his feathered ball with an expression of nothing wrong at all and innocent of the fear that sent him scrambling. He flutters and blazes coyly, a mute flame. His embers drop into the grass. Earnestly he stoops to collect them. This is where I have to remember that I need to press the button every time. Coming on to alternative values, it's a book in 8 sections. Each section is headed by a haiku that is relevant in some way. The paintings they were my challenge. What did I feel about my subject? Now, you might read the poem and think, that painting doesn't go at all. You'd paint a different painting. I would paint a different painting if I were to do it now, because I'm a different person than I was the one I was when I finished the book. But at the time, these pictures were my emotional internal landscape response to what I was writing about. Little problem with some of these, because the haikus that head the chapters, when I had an exhibition, people would come in and say, we want to peel the words off and see what the painting looks like underneath. But they are actually painted into the picture. In the book, they're printed, but if you were ever to buy a painting with the words on, they are painted by me. Love is not always about people, nor do people always find love. I like the love section. Wedding poem for you. I like that my boyfriend squirms at this when he's not here today, which is probably fortunate. Wedding poem for you. This poem contains the first time I ever saw you, standing, smiling, sitting, or just talking, looking into the eyes of other people as you spoke, or staring into the distance as if you were searching for someone, or walking with purpose, as if you were on your way to meet them. This poem remembers that I studied your ears for unsightly hair, and the profile of your nose for an unattractive bulbous end or excessive asymmetry. These were physical cautions that accompanied my observation of the size of your belly. If I could not get past that, there was no point in presenting myself. Also, your height and shoulder breadth. Would I have to defend you in a bar fight, or could you take care of yourself? The smell of your feet and the brightness of your teeth would come later if you wanted me, and if you didn't believe that I was the most stunning woman you'd ever seen, the Lolita of your dreams in every respect, then I'd have simply thought you ignorant. Whereas now we're marrying, I know you are a man of superior intellect. He'd be running out of the door at that last line. I'm sure you've all heard the phrase, if only I knew, I'd have told them, you know, if we lose somebody or they move away or I wish I'd done something but I was deprived of that opportunity. This poem is about that. And that's why. One last kiss. You'll do anything for one last kiss, you say, but why? You had it, and you didn't know then that it was not to be followed by others. If that man, woman, or child were to be brought back from that other place of death or desertion or separation by some non-negotiable distance, and you had that one last kiss, what then? A pain of separation and departure all over again? Pain repeating pain, no joy for either? Do you really mean that in that one last kiss you would pour all your love and tenderness in order to assure that other person of the love you feel? How would that lessen loss? If that one last kiss is still the thing you long to give someone, then give it now before they're gone. Give it daily. Never be caught out for never passing on the one last kiss you'd give just because you didn't know that's what it was. If you remember the heading haiku, Ever since I was a teenager, I have loved motorbikes. I came on one today. But for years, I could never afford the lessons to pass my test and the motorbike at the same time. So I was always putting it off until I got old and craggy and, you know, time, circumstances changed. Actually, it was a tax rebate. I got a tax rebate and that was it. I was off. So love perm for a motorbike. I'd always hoped I'd overcome the craving and forget about two wheels and an engine. During years in offices, wearing pencil skirts too tight to allow the necessary overseat leg swing, I'd watch motor guzzies and Nortons go by, straighten the crease in my stockings and step in heels from a car. In an effort to release myself from the sensation that I was somehow other than the woman I appeared to be, and that the skin I wore was ill-fitting, I stopped looking at motorbikes, or motorbike magazines, or men on those machines. I told myself that motorbikes were not made to carry dogs and cats or cart worldly goods from bedsits to flats. So I mothballed my plans for two wheels of any kind. No Kawasakis or Harleys for me, just Fords and Subarus, the sort of vehicles that serviced life but dulled the mind. And life passed by, although the wish for a motorbike continued like an inexplicable itch. Obscured by flesh, it tattooed my bones with an engine number of my own, beneath which black paint and chrome, pistons as heartbeat, ignition key like a compass, always the means to get home. I think you'll get the idea. You see, we go into love, life, death, and so on. Life is the forging of the spirit in the fire of experience. And this was one of my early experiences. My father used to stop at bookshops with my brother and me in the car when we were very little. I'll just be a minute, maybe 10. I sort of guess that some of you might have had experience of this. And 10 minutes would turn into 20, would turn into an hour. I mean, you pick up a book, you pick up another book. You know, they're all attached to each other. So there we were, my brother and I, and my father popped into another bookshop, and this is what happened. The rolling car. The crimson Morris Traveller loses footage at the hilltop. My younger brother sticking like an obstinate dough ball to the back seat, on which we will die. So I sit, pleading, unwilling to leave him as the street bottom wall speeds towards us in the periphery of my 7-year-old panic vision, gaining on us. My father is agape on the pavement, outside the bookshop into which he'd vanished an hour ago. Someone points, I shout, and he hurtles himself after the car and through the open window, pulling on the handbrake as if uprooting a tree. My brother remains mute, his face a stone on his shoulders, pretending he knew our father would save us, when really this is a one-off, and next time the crash is inevitable. There might be a poem after this festival too. The Cheltenham Festival, this is a few, I've actually done it a couple of times since, this poem, but it was odd, and again, I was on a motorbike. And I wrote it, and the painting is about... Nothing is ever all good or all bad. Everything is always intertwined. And it was such a strange day that I did have to write about it. I arrive in the green room dressed in motorbike black to see my father gazing into my mother's eyes from every coffee table. I am surprised by the newspaper front page that has found a way to include them on the day I am reading. Unnoticed, I climb out of my leather skin to become red with a gold belt and sit to wait my turn. And when my hour is done, I vanish back into black in the corner of the green room, like a moth backing into its chrysalis. I slip two copies of my dead parents' faces into the box on my motorbike as a form of repossession and ride towards the mountains of Wales. A sheet of clear plastic, as big as a bedspread, rises from the tarmac on the other side of the central reservation, a spectre of involvement. It moves through the air like a jellyfish moves through water, across three lanes and towards me. Cars swerve and brake, but I see no escape as it swims into my lane. Its baleful edges suddenly open up, slip sideways, and swallow me whole. I accelerate to cut a pathway through this thing that has wrapped me like a roadside gift. My front tire rips through the synthetic skin, and the two sides separate. One flies off to another life, the other fixes itself like a flapping sail to my exhaust pipe. Even as I hit my hazards and move between cars to the hard shoulder, now I am a boat in jeopardy, and the other ships part for me. Peeling the threat from hot blackened chrome, I realize how the wrong luck could have ended the day. With more sense of life than when I left, my parents as talisman, I make my way home. This sounds a little like a recipe. 3 minutes without air, 3 days without water, 3 weeks without food. Apparently, that's pretty much it. The following two poems are very similar in the sense they're about what happens after somebody dies. And they're two of my favourites. In fact, a friend of mine recently lost her brother to cancer, and one of the first things she did was email and say, look, can I have a copy of those poems? Because you'll see why, I think. It's a personal taste. For the living left behind. No one dead who loved you would wish your future years dismembered against the rocks of their departure. They would not sentence you to the guilt of betrayal for any moment they weren't uppermost in your mind. Nor would they wish you whittled down like a stick to pick the stony teeth in the open mouth of abject misery. Daily, until you are nothing left. No one dead who loved you would want your still breathing carcass to be lost in the wilderness that spans the two worlds of the living and the dead, where you are neither dead nor living. They would not applaud your misery, but would weep to watch their loss made pointless by the waste of you. The dead become a part of us, our skin, our bone, our thinking. Their existence is continuous in us, and the best we do in everything as we move on from the moment of their passing. Step back from the graveside where nothing flowers. Do not undo the best they did for you. And on the same theme, being in the death section, as we are, about loss. It's thirsty work standing up here in front of you. It's good I don't have a lapel mic, otherwise you'd hear every glug. They gave me ice cubes once with a lapel mic. That was awful. There's no getting away from the crunch. About loss. We borrow people by blood or birth, marriage or friendship, but that they are not ours to keep. We do not possess them. We have no rights, not even in partnership or parenthood. Sometimes they drift off like balloons caught in the breath of others, distracted by other countries, other friends, other relatives and lovers, and sometimes death. Maybe they polished us in passing so we shone, but we are never less because they're gone, nor are we lost, for we remain. Our time together was never to be infinite. We disregard the truth of impending separation that manifests again in each relationship. Our illusion of in perpetuity, somehow ignoring loss of life, divorce, or simply falling out or out of love. All beginnings initiate and end. The time between and the nature of that final severance are all that's questionable. If we live loveless in order to avoid the pain of loss, then our cowardice reduces us to shallow puddles of ourselves, evaporating. So love and let it end when it must. Be glad that time was had at all. It is part of you, this loss. It lends you history. Not meant to harm, it becomes your tapestry, and in this way, you retain the missing and the dead in memory. They are born into the years ahead in the minds of others, and so discover the root of immortality. Which is why we should always plan ahead. What we become tomorrow is because of the choice we make today. When I was a teenager, I was very conscious that when somebody said, oh, just take your top off, we're just like a photograph for, you know, remember our, you know, boyfriend-girlfriend relationship, and I would say no, because you never know what's going to happen. And now it's lethal. I mean, they take a photograph, it's all over the world. So I was quite conscious that what I put into my life, if it were a box when I was in my teens, was probably what I was going to be taking out of it now. Not all my choices were wise ones, obviously, because that would be really boring, but they were genuinely quite good. I wish it was easier to persuade teenagers. You know, if you do this now, the trouble is you're quite often the parent when you're saying that, so you're the wrong person for them to listen to. But this, I wrote this poem because my aunt, who died early this year, was in a nursing home at the end of her life, and it was watching how people were cared for and dealt with. And I'm always really struck by anyone who thinks that they might not be that older person than themselves. You know, if we're 60 or 70, well, we're not going to be like that 90-year-old over there. If we're 15, we're definitely never going to be like that 40-year-old. So this poem is about that. Because if we're lucky enough, we probably will be that person. The male nurse will not touch the darkly blemished skin that so revolts him, if it be avoidable. He gets the old man to expose his own leg sores and rub the ointment in. He is disparaging, too, in his lack of pleasantry, of the old man's slackening grip on things, like plates and spoons, the concept of infinity, or anything with liquid in. He thinks the old man's sensibilities have withered with his features. He thinks the old man's fear of pain and his humiliation at this loss of dignity are somehow buried in the rotting cupboard of his brain. He thinks he is immune, that the old man's disease will never claim him. He ignores the fact that his own clock is winding down to this dependence, where another man may judge him spent despite his pleas and in the face of his tenacity on life. Then he too will cease to matter and be done, though he will want to matter when this is the man he has become. Remember the mention of the photographs? My partner and I were on holiday. Well, I say holiday. It was a brief week in Portugal when it was very cold and wet. And we went out to a restaurant, and everybody is taking selfies with their food. And they're taking photos of the food, and it's going onto Facebook and Snapchat or whatever else they're doing. And I want to scream at them, just eat! You know, talk to each other. So I wrote this on for such an occasion. Selfie. You want to fix yourself into that event with an image of the volcano or street killing or house fire or fornicating bullfrogs or the centaur dancing or the unicorn piercing balloons over a pond with a fountain shaped like an oak tree from the undiscovered torts that have scattered through office blocks and suburban homes and which may be uncovered one day and be ripped from the sculpted foliage, becoming fact, causing this accumulation of lies to fall like leaves into the water below. And the unicorn to leap into fiction while you will be fixed in time to an image of crime or joy or wonder or a unicorn as a commitment for life on the internet, repeated, retweeted, but forever with your back to it. This seems quite appropriate at the moment. Your illumination of all the facts will damn you in politics. An interest in politics can begin at any age. I was thinking of adults when I wrote this. But sometimes when I look at all of us, adults, I always somehow feel that we're still the children. You know, the five-year-old, six-year-old us is still there. So Saddam Hussein, six and a half, you know, had problems with his parents, probably, you know, suffering psychologically, that sort of thing. I feel that there's still that young person who is reacting. Playing gods. Three boys are playing with stones in the dirt. They decide to call them gods because gods are omnipotent. Gods can do anything. My God, says one, rolling his large stone left and right, is the source of life. He sees everything and understands. He forgives. He teaches. He demonstrates great kindness because he can. My God, says another, does the same, but better. My God can smash your God to pieces. My God won't take shit from anyone. My God kicks ass. He lifts his heavy stone and drops it to demonstrate its great weight. The third boy watches thoughtfully, nursing his rock in the crook of his knee. My God will punish you, says the first boy, for threatening him. He's not that forgiving. My God, says the second boy, will make your women worthless. He'll cover them up, lest they be seen. They'll even collude, believing they are preserving their modesty, when in fact they're vanishing. My God will show you how your mother is cast out as a beggar when your father dies and can no longer house her. She won't even be allowed to drive to lessen her chance of escape. Your sister will be meat in a man's market and will have to marry to eat. The third boy stands to leave. What about your God? Cry the other two. My God, he says, tucking his rock beneath his arm, would make your mother's barren. Got to get to the root of the problem. Here's another political statement for you. You are not free to speak your mind if your opinion does not comply. Which brings us on to a woman in this case, it could have been be anybody, who examines others, or examines the work of others, I should say, rather than creating anything, she dissects. And she loves her work. She's a clever woman, that one. She knit her words like poison charm, her wit sharp like hypodermic, her armor on. She spiked her pen and wrote out her verdict. Her face, poor brilliant, was hid, except through that quick thought, as she did unpick her specimen from where it writhed and squirmed upon its paper stage. Spatchcocked, its efforts all laid out upon the page, its lungs, its tongue, its liver and its heart still pumping. She found it was more interesting to separate its parts than to step back and observe the sum of its performance, the purpose of its art. You can see I'm very much into the kind of self-help. When born, we are planted, but it is always up to us to flower. And it is, we can be given anything we want, can't we? I mean, we can be given all the help you can imagine. But if people don't strive to make the best of what materials they have within themselves, nothing's ever going to happen. So this is about a woman, could be any woman. It's no one in particular, but it's the idea of somebody who becomes more open to everything as a result of her own problems or the things that she has gone through. Woman as window. You are smashed, somehow broken. Net wire set in glass and dropped on concrete. Things have happened to you to alter your integrity, yet your shapes remain in place. But now you are hinged and hang, swinging from a coat hook, a shattered cloak no one can wear, because your edges will love flesh and leave bloody kisses on their skin. Your angles will nip hairs and pinch the creases of movement. You have become dangerous. Handled clumsily, you could split a vein or slice an artery. Don't misunderstand me. I know you wanted this mobility. Before, you were a thing of stiffness and transparency. Now you have character, and your facets are fascinating. I watch you glitter, your reflections dance back at you from the eyes of others as you step into your new world, still fresh from your breakages, but with a deeper understanding that can only come from being broken. I meet a lot of people who want that blown up big. Relatives know how to pull the root that taps our most sensitive nerve. And you must have that, you know, our relatives know exactly which button to push to send us off the deep end. Sometimes it's just that look. There are some very personal poems in this section, and I have to do a little background for the one I'm going to read next. When I was a child, I lost my memory. When I say I lost my memory, I didn't actually get it back. It would probably be more accurate to say that around the age of just before four, sort of after, before, funnily enough, my mother died. I always thought it was because my mother died, I sort of went into a blank space. No, it was when my parents separated. And what happened was I went into sort of blank space, and I obviously did things and spoke and reacted, because I've asked, you know, relatives, you know, distant relatives, it's all that's left now. Did I function? And apparently, yes, I did. Not well, because I was a bit grim, I think, at that point. And then one day I woke up, but it was over a year later, by which time not only had my parents separated, my mother had died, and I woke up with nothing. I knew it was actually dark. I didn't know daylight. I knew I had parents, but I couldn't see their faces. I couldn't remember their faces. I never remembered their faces. But I knew I had them, so I waited for them because I thought, well, if they appear, I'll recognize them. But I never got the memories back. So what I had to do was remake my life from that point, which would have put me around 5-ish years old. The event that caused this, I managed to retrieve many years later. So this is, and this again, if there's ever a little quartet of anything, it's always at the back of the book. So like the Four Horsemen, the memory loss poems are at the back of the book. So this is Memory Loss 1, Departure. During her visit to see my 6-month-old brother, my grandmother digs a hole in my mother, into which my father falls, tied to the anvil of his infidelity. By the time he returns from his city 2 days, my grandmother has almost succeeded in persuading my mother to take us away. In my mind's eye, an empty house greets him. I recoil from the mental image of my father's shock at the silence of a house without us in it. I follow my grandmother around our home like a toothless dog as she unravels my mother. And me, too young at not yet 3, to gather the threads, but old enough to understand her language of dismemberment. So when my grandmother leaves, I think she is beaten. Not knowing her words have pitted my mother's surface like shrapnel, the shards of which are burrowing like maggots towards her very marrow. My mother orders my father out, and my mind's eye becomes blind. I am conscious of the black fog that narrows my vision to the size of a baby's fist. Everything in front of me, the walls, the bookshelves, my father's half-open study door, disappears into the sinkhole that opens up in the floor of my vanishing world. I have this idea that if I can just cease to think or hear, then the fear and misery will eventually clear and the war will be over. Being sentient had delivered anguish, so now I slipped between the folds in my head. My body did things without me. Though I'm told I occupied my skin with heartbeat and blood flow, my thoughts were stone, and the ear that linked them to my working brain wasn't listening. Unable to put either parent back into the holes from which they tore one another, it was as if I went to sleep while still walking, hoping to wake up much later and find it was all a trick of the mind. Which brings us on to another difficult poem. I always think, people, when they lose somebody, it's like I lost my mother, there's always this sense of, you know, wanting to replace them. And we can't replace someone or something we've lost that had a big part in our life. What we have to do is learn to live around it. And that's really what this poem is about. So I like to think of it as a positive poem, although the title is a little bit disconcerting, as might the poem be. But it's about accepting something we can't change. What's the point of not accepting something we can't change? If we can't change it, we just really have to learn to walk around it or deal with it in some way. So this is about me finding a way to deal with something that couldn't be changed. Mothers. My mother's death left the child that I was lopsided because of the hole. As I grew older, that hole became a kind of cave in which my cry for my lost parent would echo plaintively. For years, I dragged that hole around with me like a piece of missing ground for other women to fall into. But if I saw a mother in them, they saw my mother in me and heard my mother's voice pleading for attention or asking for ice cream. I could hear their cries as they fell past the threshold of that gap in my side, unable to fit, unwilling to take on the challenge or live long enough. That mother-shaped hole let in the wind to chill me right down to my kidneys. Eventually, I realized that no unrelated woman could resolve this. I stared at the hole and wondered what to do with it. Since it seemed that it would never heal over, I stood back from the edge, as falling in would be to lose myself to loss and become pointless. Denial hadn't reduced it in size or importance, so acceptance was the only alternative, and to acknowledge that what it was, a bottomless pit that would always be part of my life and into which no one would fit. But that acceptance is because we have to move on through life. And it's finding how ways to do it. And I always thought, actually, that, you know, putting all that experience to good use. So I've done a stint of being a cruise counsellor, and I'm actually now a qualified counsellor, and work with troubled teenagers, which is quite interesting. Not as a job. My partner always says, you must tell people this isn't what you do for a living anymore. It's just a bit aside. The poetry in the painting is in the main thing. So it's how we look at things. And this is really what this book is about, alternative values. How do we look at things that would make it better or worse for us? Because actually, it's all in our power. And so this book, I hope, encompasses a lot of the things that I went through with that. One of them, the title poem, I have a lot of animals and owls. I actually have 10 owls now. And I have plenty of opportunity to observe them as they work their way around their little lives. And one of the things I love about the owls is the way they move their head and they do that eye thing on their neck. And I've always wondered why. And I watch and I can see that what they seem to be doing is fixing on a point, moving their neck so they can see how the background moves behind that point to get a distance and a judgment, and then they can go and they can hit it, land on it, eat it, whatever. So alternative values. The owl does not always look ahead with eyes on the horizontal. Sometimes it will tilt its visual axis by 90 degrees as if checking the position of an object against its own foothold on reality. Just as what we think we see is not always the truth. And we should wait for an alternative view to be delivered by word of mouth, the passage of time, or by shifting our attitude like the owl that knows it is all a matter of perspective. He'd be out the door and down the street by now. We're going to end a couple of minutes early, if that's all right, as I have done a bit of a whistle-stop tour. Just 5 minutes. But I'd like to end on this one. Another wedding poem for you. I've sat and worked at these words until they were tortured into this complacency. They have littered the desk like tatty knotted threads, snipped from the back of this poem as if it were a piece of embroidery which, when turned over, would display some peacock vision of colours. But the actual design is giving me some trouble. So this poem is less peacock and more peahen. But then again, all I wanted to do was describe how deep my feelings run for you without actually stitching those syllables into the fabric of this poem, because they are hackneyed, often abused, and sometimes even lie. But here they are, noticeable for their field greens and in-your-face reds, the colours of grass and lovers' roses, common only because they are many. But so are lovers, each believing what they feel is the only time in history those feelings have been real, just as we do. Thank you very much.